Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Cope Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hey, it's Aaron, the co-host of this podcast. You may remember that last year around this time, we did a five-part series of interviews with winners of the prestigious George Polk Journalism Award. Well, we're back every day this week, Monday through Friday. We're going to do a new interview each day with a different Polk Award winner or Polk Award winning duo discussing the work that earned them the award. Today, the first in the series, I talked to Julia Steers and Amel Gatatfi from Vice News about their reporting on the Wagner militia, both in Russia and in Africa. It's a really great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. And stay tuned for more interviews with Polk Award winners later this week. Hello, welcome to the Long Form Podcast, Julia Steers and Amel Gatatfi.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your Polk Award. You are a journalist, host, and producer at Vice News, or formerly of Vice News. I'm not sure exactly what state that is in. We can discuss that. But the piece was produced for Vice News and is called Inside Wagner. And is exactly what it sounds like, literally inside Wagner, the Russian mercenary group. So maybe you could both just like tell me a little bit about what you were doing before this that sort of led into this piece, what you cover, what you work on.
Sure, if we can remember life before Wagner consumed us. I have been based in Nairobi, Kenya for the last 9 years. I was a freelance journalist, and for the last 4 years or so, I've been a correspondent and the Nairobi bureau chief for Vice.
And I was an international producer for many years at Vice, mostly focusing on Middle East and Africa. And Julia and I met covering another war in Ethiopia, but then realized we were both obsessed by the same thing.
So Julia, what did you move to Kenya with, and how does one move to Kenya and start reporting?
Sure. Were you just a naive young journalist, I think is the question, and the answer was yes. But I'd left CBS News. I was a producer at CBS News, really wanted to be in the field, really wanted to cover African stories, got the sense that being at an American network was not the best place to do that. And so I quit and moved to Nairobi with the aim of covering East and West Africa, essentially. And yeah, for a while, I was really just writing for anyone, working a lot for European TV, started working with Vice as a freelancer, really working for everyone and anyone for a number of years, and then worked for the Wall Street Journal for a stint, and then full-time for Vice.
I am going to forget who said this on the show. I think it was possibly James Verini, who also lives in Nairobi, but he was like, I don't actually report on Kenya very much, but it's a very well-located place to take a flight to cover most of Africa and the Middle East. Has that been sort of like, are you kind of spread out around that beat?
Yeah, exactly that. I think in some way it's actually nice not to cover where you live, and Kenya is a lovely place to live and have a life. So aside from a few Kenyan elections, the majority of my reporting has been, you know, Horn of Africa, which are Kenya's neighbors, Sudan, Somalia, West Africa. And then again, sort of back to that naive but quite earnest desire to cover stories that weren't really being covered by American media, started reporting places like Burundi, Central African Republic, and those types of places, which ultimately did lead down the Wagner path.
So as a producer, Amel, like you get this topic, Wagner, it's a sprawling topic. It takes place in Moscow and Ukraine and Africa and Syria. It's like, it's got tentacles all over the world. How do you start like organizing that into a story? What are sort of the parameters of, you know, what you can try to achieve? And I think this is about 45 minutes long. It's a whole whole episode of the show. So it's like half a feature documentary. It's a lot.
I think what was helpful that this project was 2 years in the making. And when we started thinking about it in our separate routes, Wagner wasn't a known entity in any way. The first time I encountered them or heard about them was while working in Syria. And you sort of would hear that there are Russians that are present here, which is, you know, during the when Russia swooped in to help Assad push out rebels as well as ISIS, so they say. And then they would say there are also other types of Russians, but those guys, we don't know exactly who they are. And they seem to be hanging around oil fields and they leave a different impression than regular Russian soldiers. And I think Julia was hearing about them in Central African Republic at the beginning as well. So the idea that we would also cover them in Ukraine and that we would also try to go to Russia and that we were also trying to chase them in Sudan and even got our visas 2 days before the war happened, that idea, thankfully, did not even occur to us. I think it was genuinely, we were separately on separate lanes trying to figure out how do we access, not even for me at the time, not even the group, how do we access people who know the group? They were genuinely that elusive and they had a pattern of going after journalists who had tried to investigate them. They killed three journalists of Central African Republic, I think in 2018, or they're alleged to have done that. They also went after allegedly another journalist in Russia who was investigating deaths of their own fighters in Syria. So I think at the time, I mean, it was more just, can we meet anybody who knows anything about this anywhere? And the idea that we would make a 45-minute documentary was not even remotely a possibility at the time.
How did the events that took place in those 2 years, which are a lot of events in the Wagner story, change how you approach the story? And how do you think about like reporting on something that's in motion in that way? I mean, like, I feel like the Prigozhin column to Moscow, like, just happened. I don't know, how long ago was that? Like less than 6 months ago?
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah. It was over, it was in August or no. It was earlier in the year.
It was earlier because we were in Russia in July.
Yeah.
Okay. So you probably remember where you were during some of these events, but like what are the editorial decisions that come into play when you know, oh, this isn't coming out next week. We need to be like building this, knowing it's moving while we're building it.
So that also developed quite a bit because just to give the sort of the broader context of how sort of in the shadows they were calling themselves Russian contractors. We knew they were Wagner. When we were actually on the ground with them for a month in the Central African Republic, the war or this current war in Ukraine had not started yet. In fact, the invasion started when we were in car, because we remember discussing it with our Wagner hosts. And so at that point, Prigozhin had never acknowledged he was involved in the group. You know, now everyone, like my random auntie, knows Wagner. It's been so widely covered. But at the time, nobody knew Prigozhin. Now he's a household name. So in a way, editorially, it lent itself to that, I think, because it was this sort of emerging from the shadows. And what we shot in Car, we were saying they are in the shadows. And then you have to sort of reckon with the fact that some of our strongest footage, actual access to this group that other Western journalists have not accessed, we say, oh, these guys are operating completely in the shadows. And then we have Prigozhin on Telegram and all sorts of Russian social media, you know, saying we're not at all in the shadows a couple months later. So it was, from a reporting standpoint, a production standpoint, an editing standpoint, ultimately like a moving target, of course, with the added pressure of, you know, Central African Republic was not a story that was really on people's radars. And that, I think, in many ways enabled the Russians to make such inroads as they have done there. But as we were reporting it out, every other major media outlet were putting sort of like massive Wagner reporting teams together. And, you know, we were trying to keep up with the evolving nature of the story and also get access to places where, you know, Amel and I mostly report in the Middle East and Africa. We don't primarily report in Ukraine and Russia and that sort of thing. So it was a lot of moving targets and sort of testing the limits of things. And when we went to Russia, I think we got accreditation 2 days before this event that we were supposed to go to was taking place, you know, just enough time to get there physically. So it was all a bit of a scramble in that sense, but also exciting to cover that sort of evolving story and to worry that you'll get beat on access when everybody else starts covering it too. It can be motivating.
I think like one of our aims was we don't necessarily need to be first with a big documentary that's about this group. We were sort of aspiring to make the most in-depth documentary we possibly can. And also, we both really love making documentary. And so something that's extremely watchable and beautiful and cinematic, and you watch it from zero to end. That was sort of the aspiration. So we're doing that while Prigozhin, I mean, he couldn't have timed his Telegram messages worse sometimes for us because because his drama would coincide with Vice's bankruptcy and Vice's various events.
Right, the budget challenges were significant as well.
which was a different challenge. So we had three things, which was we really want to make something that's high quality and very watchable and accessible to anybody and well reported as well. Sometimes those two things are hard to marry in a documentary, especially when you're looking for real scene, you're looking for real moments that unfold in front of camera, and you're looking for genuine human interaction that lends itself to the reporting that you've done off camera. And then you have sort of this ever-evolving story. I was just looking through our notes. We have so many different plans for different places and different supposed scenes. And then he would announce something, or he would go on a different tangent, or another documentary would come out, or something else would happen that would kind of, sometimes we would respond to it. And sometimes one of us would have to say, okay, stay strong and eyes on the prize. Let's not get distracted and let's stay focused on what it is that we're doing. In addition to sort of the newsroom environment that we were in, that we both love a lot, but it's a public fact that it was definitely in turmoil. So dealing with all of those things simultaneously was actually a very good muscle, because that's what freelance journalism feels like in a lot of ways now. But I don't think we had anticipated that the story would end with his death, an alleged assassination, and that it would end being shot in Russia.
Anyone who predicted that whole sequence of events is that got a prescient view. I mean, to have anticipated those events would have been pretty wild. But
yeah,
the most like shocking moment for me watching it is when Wagner invites you to their camp in Central African Republic. I was like, what are you guys doing? Don't invite them there. They're going to... One, I'm curious how that came about, and also what the motivation for them to let a reporter in there when they were, you know, clearly kind of suppressing the information that any reporter would be looking for within the camp. And it wasn't like particularly well hidden. There's like a bunch of guys with the Je suis Wagner t-shirts, which always suspicious when people are wearing a t-shirt with your band's name that band doesn't exist. But tell me about like
sort of pushing for that kind of access and how you get it and why they would agree to something like that?
Sure. So as I said, I have been reporting in Central African Republic for quite a few years, since 2016. And I think that really helped. And they arrived in 2017, 2018 under this UN deal. And I was actually there on the ground on another story completely when people started talking about, oh, the Russians are arriving. What are they going to do here? They're at this secretive base just outside of the capital. And essentially since then, the push for access really started. And I would just sort of constantly pester them to let us come film a training at least and that sort of thing. And that was under the first boss, the head of the mission there, a guy called Valery Zakharov. He never wanted to give us access, but, you know, we always stayed in touch with our Russian contacts on the ground, including a guy who has sort of gone from being a translator to one of the head guys in Wagner who's been on the ground for 8 years at least. So kept pushing. There was a new head of mission who's in the film called Vitaly Pervilev. He's the one who ultimately gave us access, and he is who I was engaging with. A very different kind of guy than the former boss. The former boss was sort of from KGB Central Casting. Vitaly is ex-French Foreign Legion, obviously a patriot in many ways, but still a sort of a more sophisticated way of interacting with media, I think. And he really grew the mission there. But essentially, you know, I really just kept badgering them and engaging with them. And, you know, as long, even though they kept saying no, 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 as long as they're engaging with you, you know, like there's some reason that they're trying to talk to you. And that was probably 18 months in the making. And then went to Bangui, to the capital, to negotiate with them in person for access. And I think that in many ways sealed the deal, just going and having conversations with them. They were also familiar with some of our previous work there. So the year before, I had been there covering this rebel insurgency marching on the Capitol. The Russians played a really pivotal role in that battle, and they had seen our coverage of that, which included this rebel leader that they were actually like on the hunt for. So they did indicate that they had, I suppose, some level of respect for some of our previous reporting and experience in Carr. But, you know, there's always also that sort of bit of magic or just like, you know, you don't know what in the human interaction, aside from you just sending them the message that I'm extremely stubborn and I probably won't go away until you give us access. Ultimately, I don't know why they said yes. I think Vitaly is really a true believer. And, you know, he explained a lot to us off camera, kind of constantly fighting with us about Western powers versus Russia and all of this stuff. And I think he felt he really had a viewpoint to show that what they're doing there, war crimes aside, which we're not going to talk about those from their perspective, what they're doing there was not all bad. You know, he also said the independence of Vice, you know, not being sort of a government owned network and that sort of thing, and having seen some previous Vice work was interesting to them. So I think there were a number of factors, but he did believe that they had something to say. And whether or not, you know, I think they did that quite clumsily. Originally, he didn't want to be on camera. He refused to be on camera, even when we were on the ground with him. And then he, you know, he features quite a bit in the piece. So that all changed. I think it's just part of that sort of evolving relationship with the source.
Yeah. And I think it's funny that you say, oh, I don't let them in because they're going to ask some uncomfortable questions. And I think that was definitely on his and Dmitry CT's mind. But I think his logic was that for whatever reason, at this moment, it's more important for us to make our case because this is actually going very well. And we have actual factual things that we can share about how effective we are on the ground here in Central African Republic.
Yeah.
So if we can show them that, that is a useful platform for us. And for us,
and his argument was really like they're a very viable alternative to, in that case, French power, but more generally, you know, Western influence in Africa. And the way that they sort of essentially achieved state capture in Central African Republic was sort of a good model for them to be flaunting in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that element works for them. And we also had to grapple with, like, you know, to an extent, that's like their propaganda that they're trying to get out. So you have to also figure out how do we report this glimpse into their world that nobody else is getting, but also not just sort of give a platform for that kind of message.
And I think the thing though with him is that he sort of troubleshooted how to control the message, if that makes sense. We were there for almost a month. And early in our trip, we felt we could be independent. And so we would film with them. And then we were arranging interviews on the side. And one of the interviews that we were trying to do was an interview with someone who would have become a whistleblower. He was an ex-Central African soldier who had worked with them in the field. And he would say something about how he had witnessed them committing atrocities. And obviously, that's an important perspective for us to add nuance to the film. And so when we arranged to meet him, we ended up getting arrested by rebel forces on behalf of Wagner. It turned into an extremely intimidating situation, but that was also a very effective one. Even though we decided to stay in Car for another 3 weeks, it was obvious that we were being watched the entire time. It was obvious that our moves were being monitored and that we really couldn't step outside of the parameters that Vitaly and his colleagues had set for us.
What are sort of the outer limits in terms of personal safety in a situation like this? Like, it definitely didn't seem safe. You know, for younger journalists out there, not that anyone should take this as an example to just try something like this, but like, even between the two of you, what are like discussions about like what you will do and won't do? And, you know, when would you pull the plug on something like that?
I think Amel and I are similar in that, you know, Amel covered ISIS. She's covered Syria and Yemen. I've covered any number of conflicts in Africa. And it can look in the reporting and on camera like we're just constantly doing crazy stuff. And what you don't see is one, like some expertise in the region, some language skills in the region, really fastidious preparation, trying to know the context of a country as much as possible. And of course, relying on really trusted local colleagues as well. So there's so much that goes into that. I mean, even just me going on this sort of recce trip by myself to go, you know, you're in constant communication with the security team and all of that. And Amel and I are in constant communication with each other and with the camera people who we work with on the ground on that. That said, Central African Republic in general as a context can sort of lull you into a false sense of security, but also really has that element of really anything can happen at any time. And I felt in a way lucky that I had known that from previous reporting, because when the situation that we walked into when we got arrested seemed very calm in the evening, going to someone's home, and then within seconds, you know, pickup trucks of military ex-rebels, sort of vague armed men showed up to arrest us. It was really happened in a split second, and I think to me was quite shocking in that respect. So you prepare as much as you can. And then, you know, for us, I think we only go to the field with people who, you know, have sort of similar limits. Amel and I are both very aggressive in pursuing a story and pursuing access and trying to get it right. But we also don't want to die. We don't have a crazy death wish. I think we try and go as far as possible. And I think having that dialogue as well, you know, so in terms of a message to younger colleagues who might see this and think it looks cool and try and do it, there's no sort of replacing some level of experience and like ramping up to that level of risk. But also, I think going to the field with colleagues who, you know, have a similar assessment of things in a literally life and death scenario. And it's almost an unspoken thing. You know, when you're in that sort of trouble, you can't really communicate with each other because all these guys are shouting at us. So like the cameraman sitting down quietly, trying not to make eye contact, trying not to be aggressive. Amel and I are looking at each other in the eyes. We're looking at him in the eyes. So it's almost an unspoken thing as well when you're actually sort of in that moment of real risk.
I went down a rabbit hole after I watched this. It just keeps playing videos for you. But I watched another video that you produced, Amel, that was inside Al-Hol, the prison, where ISIS, former ISIS members and mostly mm-hmm. other families are detained. It was particularly interesting to me. I had read Anand Gopal has a story about Al-Hol in the newest New Yorker.
Yeah.
I was in Al-Hol mode, but you know, there's a quality in that piece and in this piece where depending on like what perspective you are starting with, it's difficult to like say who the good and bad people are would be a way too easy way to describe it. But mm-hmm. there's someone in this story to whom these Wagner mercenaries are like cops protecting them from rebels, right? Like there's like a lot of scrambling of what roles different people are playing. How do you deal with an environment like that, that where it's more complicated than two sides of good and evil, and that people have really complicated motives? And also, like, you're sort of in that situation relying on what this Kurdish raiding force is telling. You know, there's all of these different people with their own agendas. So I'm curious how you think about, like, reporting in environments like that.
That's such a good observation. Yeah, it is. And it's also kind of something that I'm personally very interested in, the gray area. I grew up between Algeria and the US for the first 6 years of my life, and a bunch of places in North Africa and the Middle East. And so my family is a mix of different kinds of people. So I'm always sitting in the gray area. And I do not like when something seems really simple. And it makes me uncomfortable if I feel very confident that I know what my opinion is and I'm not changing my mind at all. I think on a personal level, the moment I'm starting to believe one line too much and not question it is the moment I start really worrying. And I think, like, with the El Hol camp, I always kind of was teetering in between who exactly is telling the truth. And I think if that's what's happening in the field, especially for Doc, you need to find a way that the piece itself, including cinematically and voiceover and the score that you choose when you're editing, and even the way the shots are framed, reflects that. Like in Central African Republic, when they pull out the rebels, and we didn't completely know what the hell was going on. We get out of these pickup trucks, and then, like, people are like, hey, 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 and they, and all these dudes start walking and they line up, and we're all just sort of, yes, can we help you? And so you need to find a way to shoot it in a way that it reflects this sort of confusion. Because if you, even for example, in the framing in that moment, Zach, one of our cinematographers on this piece, he and I, we were sort of like whispering throughout, like, try to find a way to juxtapose the Russians and the rebels in a lot of the shots, because that's how we feel. We see them watching in the background, but the rebels are the ones who are in the forefront. But I think...
Well, you want the audience, the viewer, to feel that, what we felt in that moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Between you and Zach and the editor, that's a real skill that is also hard to do while reporting in the field, that, you know, Amal is quite good at. It's a great feeling to be back and sort of handing over the footage and have the editor or the senior producer say, oh, wow, I really felt that awkwardness or that tension or whatever, you know, to know that it sort of came off. And it's not as easy as just, like, sort of pointing the camera at something that's very intentional.
But I think from a reporting perspective, I kind of, you want to be extremely skeptical and never really buy one single side. And if you're walking away as someone who's watching either of these pieces a little bit confused and a little bit skeptical, like, you've learned something, but you're skeptical about all the lines that have been fed to you, then that's a job well done. There's a lot of layers to things. And if you're simplifying stuff and making it seem like there's a clean bad guy and a clean good guy because that's just an easier story to tell, then you're really missing out. And so is whoever is watching.
And we talked about that so much, like, particularly as Ukraine ramped up and the role of Wagner in Ukraine became huge front page news every day. We wanted people to understand our work in reporting with some level of nuance and not just go into it thinking, well, Russia bad, Russian mercenaries must be bad. You know, we did. There's a geopolitical element to their involvement in a lot of African countries that is much more nuanced than that. And, you know, Amal is really good at getting that to come across in filmmaking. And I think we're both attracted to stories that get a little of that gray area in the mix.
What you said about sort of how you frame those images, really, I really identify with that, because, like, I don't remember his name, but the head of the mercenaries Central African Republic, you know, when he was kind of talking, I was like, this guy does seem sincere. He's got kind of an Elon Musk thing going on, the way he looks.
He's kind of like a, you know, dorky vibe. Mm-hmm.
But I also was like, this isn't pure propaganda. Like, if you asked me, I would be like, I think this person believes what they're saying, believes in their mission. They may believe that their mission may include human rights abuses, but it's a little bit different than when we're sort of told about a mercenary who's like just a guy cashing a check. You know, he reminded me more of a soldier
exactly
than like a mercenary, I guess.
He's a true believer in many ways. And, you know, people do all sorts of mental gymnastics in war to sort of get themselves to the place where they're committing horrible atrocities, you know, for whatever cause.
Yeah, I think that's why you sort of never know entirely why someone is doing something. But if you give them the space and you allow them to explain what it is that they're thinking, it's just a little bit more useful to the story than, you know, doing voiceover over their faces.
How do people perceive you as a Algerian American woman who's chosen to like go into the Middle East and do this kind of reporting? Like what kind of reactions do you get from people, and how do you feel like your sort of own past informs what you do?
This is something that Julia and I talk a lot about. Algeria has a 132-year history of colonialism with the French. It's something that I was definitely taught in school. And so I'm aware that it informs how I see a lot of these conflicts, especially actually in Africa. Sometimes it's very helpful because no one knows where Algeria is. And that's just sort of great because you're some sort of neutral. Where? What is? How? What is it? And that's sometimes helpful because you can just be whatever it is that they think you are. And then sometimes it's useful actually with rebels and people who are fighting for a cause that they believe in, because that's how Algeria, along with a lot of diplomatic effort, but that's how Algeria got its independence in 62. And so people relate to that cause. That's been a useful and relevant thing. But then I think sometimes also people are skeptical because I don't know. I'm curious actually what Julia thinks of this, but I think sometimes in some worlds, people perceive a white journalist as sort of a blank slate who can go from place to place.
Yeah, totally.
Which is actual bullshit, because we're all real human beings and everyone has their biases. And so I think occasionally it's perceived as this bias, but to me, it's nothing but a strength, in the same way that any of your life experiences, even your own family dynamic, can be a great strength in the field in Rebels, even though they're worlds and worlds apart.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's sort of, I think it really depends on the context, but Algeria has a few weird little nodes that hit the right spot with rebels and people who believe they're fighting for various causes, for better or for worse, to be honest.
Julia, what's it like being a blank slate that can go place to place without a past?
No, I do think that's true. And people are so sort of used to, you know, whether it's American or British journalists, sort of, you know, it's a culture of parachute journalism largely. And that's a big part of why I wanted to be based somewhere. And having been based somewhere and still knowing that there's so much that I don't know about the countries that I report in, the idea of parachute journalism scares me even more. But I do think I have never leaned, someone asked me recently actually about the Wagner access, like, well, how did you negotiate with them as an American woman? And it was such a peculiar question to me, because I'm not flying to Bangui thinking, well, I'm here and I'm American. And so, you know, Vitaly already wanted to argue about like Cold War politics and the US versus Russia and all that stuff that I really didn't identify with as my politics or something that I grew up with, because I grew up in a post-Cold War era. So, and I think I said to this person, well, I never sort of go in like, ah, here I am as American. You know, if anything, as an American traveling to a lot of places that you do, you're like kind of hiding the passport as soon as you get through, you know, immigration, because America is not an uncontroversial country pretty much anywhere. And increasingly, everybody knows politics in the US. And so everybody has their sort of assumptions about it. So I said to this person, you know, I really try not to lean into my Americanness in any way, really. And, you know, I think being a woman can work to your advantage. You're very often underestimated. I think to some extent, a lot of sort of rebel groups and probably the Wagner guys underestimated us for that reason, perhaps, you know, sort of. But as Amal said, you know, like you use the parts of your identity occasionally that you think might help you make a human connection. But mostly I try and, you know, leave myself out of it as much as possible. The shoot was an interesting one because I was pregnant at the time, like 6 or 7 months pregnant at the time. And that was the first time that I was like, really like, we got to hide. Normally you do just try and sort of fade into the background and like kill them with your questions in the interview. But this time Mel knew and we were trying to hide it from them because we didn't want them not to let us on helicopters and into the sort of deep field stuff outside of the Capitol. So that was actually the first time that I was actively ever thinking like, oh, there's this thing about myself that I would like to hide.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good point. In the end, the thing that matters the most in the field, regardless of where they think you're from and what your whole deal is if you have done enough pre-reporting, you actually know why you're here. And you also know what you don't know. Yeah. I think that's a really important thing. And that's a conversation that Julia and I have a lot, which is, am I being crazy? Like, is there something here that I just don't understand? Should I go back and read this? Or should I go back and have another conversation with someone before? What am I missing here? So as long as you reflect that you both have done as much due diligence as possible, but also understand that, look, I've reported from Algeria once. I've reported from the US once. Those are the only two countries of citizenship that I have. Everywhere else, I am an outsider, regardless of how we can relate. I'm never going to pretend that I know as much as someone from a place. And so I think as long as that's at play and that reflects in how you behave and the way that you treat people, you'll be fine.
You touched earlier on this piece being reported amidst Vice's bankruptcy. I feel like this is like a happy celebration, so we shouldn't break it down by discussing
it. Let's bring it down a notch, a couple notches.
What was that like? Like being out in the field while the home base was burning down, and I guess where do you go from here? Like, what's next,
Madame?
patiently waiting for Julia.
Also, if you don't want to talk about that, it's fine.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Mel, in addition to being producer-director, was also co-CEO. So, you know, she might be a little sensitive about, yeah.
I think for me, all of that's happened with Vice is a huge loss because Julie and I both can agree that it was the only platform I can think of that was, in terms of TV and doc, that had the willingness to spend a lot of time, i.e. money, in the field on stories that no one is really watching. Even this Wagner thing, when we were doing that in the field, no one knew who they were really. And so it was genuinely just a gamble. And they were willing to take a lot of gambles. And that is something that I am eternally grateful for. And the main advantage, though, that we had was that we'd all been working together for a while. We all knew each other. We all could communicate. And it was made clear to us that, yes, the company now is bankrupt and you're en route to Russia. But if anything happens, we will have your back. Like I was at the airport.
There was still a security team in place. And yeah.
Yeah, there was still a security team. Actually, I just talked to one of the security guys yesterday about something else. And it reminded me how much camaraderie there is and how much it's impossible to do this sort of thing without getting a little bit personal. And so I think I wasn't worried during that time. I didn't think, oh, what if something happens to us in Russia? Will Vice just pretend we never met before? they just like blur out Julia's faces from previous pieces.
She joined Wagner. We're not sure what she happened to her.
She's doing comms for Wagner now.
Yeah, so I sort of had that trust. Otherwise, we wouldn't have. I don't think we would have necessarily gone. Other than that, I wish I knew more about the finances and understood sort of exactly what happened. I've also even stopped reading articles about it because
I don't.
Yeah, it's quite breathless and yet not that informative.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll ever fully gain insight. And that was part of the structure is that we make the things and then other people do the Excel spreadsheet crunching.
I would say it was definitely destabilizing, but editorially, there were people who had you know, who had our back and were fighting for the project. And at the end, it was a real fight for the project, you know, to get the last deployments in, to pay for the edit. I mean, it was sort of penny pinching towards the end, but, you know, there were enough people who believed in the project and who believed in us that it was like, we will get this out before the company folds, essentially. And I think, you know, now as Amel was saying, like, and as the newly former bureau chief overseeing Africa coverage, the loss in the landscape, you know, I'm really sort of racking my brain as plenty of people would take a Wagner documentary in this climate. However, a lot of the other kind of work that we did, 20 minutes on human rights abuses in the Central African Republic, I mean, imagining pitching that to any other print or broadcast outlet in the US is, it's kind of unimaginable, which I think is a real shame. And I think the most sort of head-scratching element of the failure of Vice is like those stories from Central African Republic or Congo or, you know, so-called obscure countries would get millions of views. So this argument that there's no appetite in the US for that kind of coverage is one that still confuses me to this day.
Yeah, I think one of the best takeaways I got from 7 or 8 years at Vice is that it's not enough for something to be important when you're figuring out how to make a story. It's the intersection of important and interesting.
Yeah.
And that has taught me that people will watch anything, anywhere, as long as it's interesting. So nobody owes us their time. The onus is on us to explain things in an interesting, captivating, compelling way. And so I'm really hoping that a landscape opens up somewhere else that sees that and understands that that can be done anywhere in the world.
I hope that as well. I also hope that this archive of the incredible work you've produced is maintained. I hope this isn't something that's going off the internet. Hopefully people are backing things up on hard drives or YouTube or something. But thank you. Thank you both so much for this interview and congratulations again on the award.
Thank you.
Thanks, Aaron.
Hey, thank you for listening to the Long Form Podcast. Thanks to Jackie Sajiko for editing this episode. Thanks to everyone over at the George Polk Awards, everyone at Vox. We'll be back with more episodes from George Polk Award winners this week.